The headlines: Iran's president calls on the U.S. to abide by its international commitments, saying Washington violated the U.N. resolution that endorsed the 2015 nuclear deal by pulling out of the accord. Myanmar's police filed charges against ousted leader Aung San Suu Kyi for breaching an import-export law, seeking her detention until February 15th. And also on our headlines, World Health Organization health experts visit a laboratory in the Chinese city of Wuhan as part of their hunt for the origins of the coronavirus pandemic. Hello and welcome, everybody. Our top story for this half hour: Iran's president says the United States should comply with the UN Security Council resolution that endorsed the 2015 nuclear deal.
The Americans should know that they have so far violated UN Security Council Resolution 2231. It's not a matter of Iran and its nuclear deal. I'm telling the Americans that it is Resolution 2231 that is the issue. It is a resolution unanimously approved by the UN Security Council.
President Rouhani reiterated, if the U.S. respects the law and fulfills its obligations, Iran will fully abide by its commitments, too. He said there is no point saying that Iran should return to the nuclear deal, as the country never left it. Iran's president also said no provision of the accord will change and no new member will join it whatsoever. He said it's widely believed in the world that the Iran deal can be beneficial for international security, peace, and unity. In 2018, the U.S. unilaterally withdrew from the accord and reinstated sanctions on Iran. Washington has reacted to comments made by the Iranian foreign minister, saying the European Union could choreograph the process of revival of the 2015 Iran nuclear deal.
When it comes to the propositions that have been put on the table, I would just go back to the proposition that we've put on the table, that President Biden on the campaign trail, and more recently, President Biden as President of the United States, Secretary Blinken as Secretary of State, have set. When it comes to the JCPOA, we are prepared to walk the path of diplomacy if Iran resumes that full compliance.
Price said the U.S. would try to extend the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action by including Iran's ballistic missile program in future negotiations, an idea Tehran has always rejected. Earlier, an EU spokesman said the bloc is pressing the U.S. to lift sanctions on Tehran and is working hard to keep the JCPOA alive. The remarks came after Iran's top diplomat Mohammad Javad Zadi said the EU could synchronize a coordinated revival of the agreement. Washington unilaterally withdrew from the Iran nuclear deal in 2018. In response, Tehran scaled back its commitments. The Islamic Republic says it will reverse those steps once all parties honor their obligations.
It's been described as a Mexican standoff, with either side waiting for the other to blink first.
If Iran comes back into full compliance with its obligations under the JCPOA, the United States would do the same thing.
We acted in strict accordance with the nuclear agreement. Now the United States needs to come back into compliance, and Iran will be ready immediately.
But let's see who did what and when. Broadly, in May 2018, former U.S. President Donald Trump unilaterally withdrew the U.S. from the nuclear deal and launched what came to be known as the Maximum Pressure Campaign on Iran. A year later, and in the absence of substantive action on the part of the European signatories to the agreement, Tehran started reducing its commitments to the accord. Given everything that happened between the two countries in 4 years of Trump, is the deal still worth the paper it's written on?
The fact of the matter is that that deal have not been honored. And if it continues not honoring the same deal, then really that deal is dead.
And Iran has offered a solution to the impasse. Get the Europeans involved. The man to get things running, EU Foreign Policy Chief Joseph Borrell. But the Americans aren't only seeking Iran's return to full compliance. President Biden has spoken of follow-on negotiations, of a longer and stronger deal. Would Tehran take it?
Really, there is no goodwill between Iran and United States. So there is no way that you could actually extend your negotiation when you haven't honored what you have already agreed.
Iran's foreign minister has warned that the U.S. does not have unlimited time to return to the deal. And he is right. The Islamic Republic is holding presidential elections in June when power could change hands. Not only that, Tehran is demanding the U.S. make up for its wrongdoings and to put an end to multi-billion dollar weapons sales to Persian Gulf dictatorships.
The path forward seems to be clear. The ball is in the court of the Biden administration to give diplomacy a second chance. And Europe can make sure diplomacy prevails. Saeed Pourreza, London.
The International Court of Justice is set to rule on whether it can take on Iran's bid to overturn U.S. economic sanctions. The ruling is expected on Wednesday. Tehran filed its lawsuit in mid-2018 after the U.S. withdrew from the Iran nuclear deal and reinstated sanctions. Tehran accused Washington of breaching a 1955 bilateral treaty and destroying millions of lives. The U.N.'s top court previously ruled that the U.S. should lift the sanctions. Washington, however, said the Hague-based court does not have jurisdiction over the case. Now, if the court decides to take on Iran's bid, a final ruling could be months or years away. The Secretary of Iran's Supreme National Security Council says U.S. withdrawal from Iraq is a prelude to its pullout from the entire region. Ali Shamkhani made the comments in a meeting with Iraqi Foreign Minister Fuad Hussein in Tehran. Shamkhani said the presence of U.S. forces causes instability and crises in the region. He thanked Iraq for issuing arrest warrants for former U.S. President Donald Trump and his Secretary of State Mike Pompeo. Tehran sees the two men as the main perpetrators of the U.S. assassination of top Iranian General Qasem Soleimani in Iraq last year. At the meeting with Shamkhani, the Iraqi minister thanked Iran for its role in maintaining stability and security in the region. Myanmar's police have filed charges against ousted de facto leader Aung San Suu Kyi for illegally importing communications equipment. In a request to a court, police said they had found walkie-talkie radios in a search of Suu Kyi's home in the capital. Police said she will remain in custody until mid-February for investigations. Earlier, Suu Kyi's National League for Democracy blasted the military for storming its offices in several regions. Suu Kyi and other NLD members were detained on Monday as part of a military coup. The army claimed fraud in November's general election that Suu Kyi's party won by a landslide. Calls are now growing for civil disobedience, with medics already stopping work at dozens of hospitals across the country. World Health Organization experts investigating COVID-19 origins have visited a major virus research laboratory in the Chinese city of Wuhan. The lab has been at the center of conspiracy theories that spread over the origins of the pandemic. The theories claim that a laboratory leak caused the outbreak in Wuhan in December 2019. The Chinese city was the first place in the world to report COVID infections. Most scientists have rejected those theories. The WHO team began its probe in China last year. They have already visited key hospitals and a Wuhan seafood market. That's where the first cluster of COVID infections is believed to have been originated. Stephen Rabe earlier joined us from Beijing. He gave us more details about the visit of the World Health Organization's team to the Wuhan virus lab.
The WHO team, after visiting the seafood market and the hospital where the disease was first identified, have actually visited the Wuhan Institute of Virology. It's swirling in conspiracy theories. Most scientists have actually rejected this, I think, because they know, you know, the process by which the horseshoe bat virus was tinkered with to enable it to infect human cells, and they can see that it's completely unrelated to the sequence of the genome which has been discovered now.
Elsewhere, the remains of the U.S. police officer who was killed last month during violent protests at Capitol Hill has been brought to the building for a ceremonial rest. President Joe Biden was present at the ceremony held on Tuesday night. Lawmakers will also pay their respect to Brian Sicknick during another ceremony on Wednesday. His remains will then be taken to Arlington National Cemetery for burial. Congress has said Sicknick would lie in honor. That's a term used for respecting the U.S.'s most eminent citizens. The 42-year-old officer succumbed to injuries he sustained after supporters of former President Donald Trump stormed the Capitol building on January the 6th. Sicknick was one of the five victims of that incident. The United States has reported more than 100,000 COVID-19 deaths since the 1st of January 2021. According to Johns Hopkins University, the virus has claimed nearly 447,000 lives in the country since the first fatality was reported nearly a year ago. Confirmed cases of the novel coronavirus have also risen to over 26.4 million. Despite mass vaccination programs being underway in the virus-stricken U.S., the country remains the world's worst hit in terms of both infections and fatalities. Meanwhile, the overall global deaths from the virus have surpassed 2.2 million, and the total number of infected people is nearing 104 million. And the issue of reopening schools during the pandemic in the U.S. has become intertwined with the increasing gap between their rich and poor. Schools in poor areas say they don't have the funding to reopen safely, but politicians and parents are pushing for a return to normality. Rami Mazzari has more from Chicago.
With a major teacher strike looming, Chicago has become the key battleground in the reopening of schools amid America's struggles handling the coronavirus. The root issue is not racial disparities or even health safety, but how the pandemic keeps worsening long-standing economic inequalities between the rich and poor classes. In the decentralized United States system, funding for schools comes mainly from local taxes. While schools in wealthy neighborhoods have plenty of resources for hand sanitizer and masks, schools in poor areas are being asked to cope with pandemic-related costs despite decades of non-investment.
Even if you open the schools, everyone still doesn't start from an equal place. You still have disparity. You still have lower quality of teachers. You still have outdated textbooks. You still have schools that don't have heat. You still have schools that may have lead in the water. Very often, those services are already lacking. So even to bring people back into the school system, you're still bringing them back into an unequal system.
This year, childcare costs have soared a backbreaking 60%. The U.S. has such a small social safety net that households with children usually require two working parents to survive economically, so reopening schools is a financial imperative for many. National health officials say schools should reopen and follow new health guidelines, but unions say a job walkout might be the only solution to show that poor areas don't have the resources to meet those guidelines.
I think that safety should be the first priority, and that, I think, would be difficult because we already have disparity in how different school systems are funded. We have disparity in what resources are in different schools. So this is a very difficult question and a very difficult problem for America to solve.
New U.S. President Joe Biden's push to reopen is the opposite of many Western nations who have reshuttered schools as a worrying coronavirus variant has emerged. Many have been surprised at the partial reopening now being politically ordered for many sectors of society, even though the daily nationwide death totals are still almost 60% more than the peak daily death totals last spring. Rami Mazzaheri, Chicago.
The Italian president says he wants to appoint a new government after talks aimed at reviving the previous coalition failed. Sergio Mattarella added that he did not want to call early elections, arguing that the country needs a strong administration to deal with the COVID-19 pandemic and the subsequent economic meltdown. He stressed that he wants a high-profile administration with cross-party backing to take office. Mattarella has summoned former European Central Bank president Mario Draghi, who is expected to be asked to lead a government of national unity. The ruling coalition of Prime Minister Giuseppe Conte collapsed last month after former Premier Matteo Renzi pulled out of his Italia Viva party. They accuse Conte of mishandling the health emergency and the subsequent economic crisis. Earlier, we were joined by our Rome correspondent Max Cevini for more on Italy's political impasse. Here's what he had to say.
Many have dubbed the government setback as the failure of Italian politics. After talks between the ruling parties failed to patch things up, In a televised speech aired a couple of hours ago, the President Mattarella announced that he would help form a high-profile government that should not identify itself with any political formula. Mr. Mattarella said that if a new government could not be formed, then Italy would have to hold early elections, a move that he said would not only create even more political uncertainty at a time of serious crisis, but it would also risk spreading the virus among voters. Italy cannot wait any longer. The country desperately needs the 220 billion euros of the European Union Recovery Fund, and to access the funds, the country needs a government. Many are wondering why former Prime Minister Renzi, who is the mastermind behind this government crisis, abruptly pulled his small party out of the ruling coalition. Some have said for a personal gain, some others said that Renzi has been instrumental to capitalist powers because at this particular conjunction, at the time when the country is about to receive hundreds of billions of euros from Brussels, Italy must have a government led by a man who truly is a man of the European Union, such as Mario Draghi, to allocate the resources to the right projects.
EU lawmakers describe conditions for thousands of refugees on five Greek islands as appalling and a shameful reflection of the bloc's values. EU member states are refusing to relocate these desperate people in defiance of international humanitarian law. Jerome Hughes reports from Brussels.
17,005. That's the precise number of refugees currently barely surviving in awful conditions on the islands of Greece, apparently a proud member of the 27-nation EU. Legislators have been discussing the situation here in the European Parliament, Brussels.
Most of the time, people are locked up in the camps. Does the Commission think this is imprisonment? And if not, what is the difference between this and imprisonment?
There are not enough toilets or hot showers in the overcrowded camps. EU lawmakers say this is all the more appalling against the backdrop of a global pandemic.
Tents have been set up in October, and only in January they start winterization, as if the arrival of winter was a big surprise. And they're tents, it's very basic.
The Parliament debate heard that 60% of the refugees have reported suicidal thoughts to doctors. On Lesbos alone, there are 129 babies under the age of one. EU nations pledged to take in 5,145 refugees from the islands, but just half that number have been relocated.
There are many people who have now been granted international protection who are still stuck in the camps. What's going to happen with them? Do we have commitment by other member states to take over people, and why is this not happening?
The argument has been made the EU has a special responsibility in this regard because of the very destabilising roles some of the bloc's countries have played in Africa and in the Middle East.
The shape of the current political landscape in the EU does not inject confidence that the bloc's asylum policy will change anytime soon, according to experts.
There is across Europe now this sense that of xenophobia, of populism, of resistance to seeing more migration. So it makes it very, very tough to do.
Lawmakers say EU governments are using the pandemic as a reason to extricate themselves from their fundamental human rights responsibilities. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Hundreds of people have fled to safety as a bushfire in Western Australia is burning out of control. The fire has already torn through large swaths of land, destroying at least 70 homes. It sparked on the outskirts of Perth on Monday and is the largest the city has seen in years. Firefighters have been battling the fire. At least six have got minor injuries. Australian authorities have warned that conditions might get worse due to strong winds fanning the flames. That comes as the city of Perth is in lockdown to contain its COVID outbreak, but officials have urged people to ignore the restrictions and leave threatened areas. That's a wrap for now.
The very first revolution that started with the people, continued with the people, did not change its word, did not change its way, did not decrease or increase its goals, is the Islamic Revolution of Iran. Ayatollah Khamenei.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم
السلام عليكم ورحمة الله
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints
همه با وجود قده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم
All of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor Israel
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
This is a part of a speech delivered on February 18, 2019 by Ayatollah Khamenei, the leader of the Islamic Revolution, during a meeting with the people of East Azerbaijan. The meeting was held at Imam Khomeini Hosseiniyeh in commemoration of the anniversary of Tabriz Uprising of February 18, 1978.
The Iranian nation accomplished a magnificent feat in this year's 22nd of Behman Rally. I will tell you that according to the report that was delivered to me, the turnout was much higher than previous years. This was the case all over the country or in 98% of the cities of the country. In certain cities, this increase was 50%, in some cities it was 40%, and in some cities the increase was 30%. The enemy sees this movement, but he denies it in his propaganda. In his propaganda, he says that only thousands of people came to the streets. They do not say that millions of people. Overall, tens of millions of individuals poured onto the streets. They do not mention this, but they understand it well enough. The enemy understands this, and the whole world knows that a country whose people are in the middle of the arena in such a united way will come to no harm from the enemy's plots and tricks. Everyone knows this.
Allah, Allah, la ilaha illallah, la ilaha illallah, Allah, 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 Allah.
Your presence at the political and revolutionary scene of the country and the commemoration of the 22nd of Behman of the year 1357, according to the solar calendar, throughout the country was an important political and security move, which was made by the Iranian nation. One should thank God because our hearts are in His hands, legs have moved on your path, and heads have turned towards you. Our hands are stretched towards God, and hearts are in His hands. It was God who brought the people to the arena, and therefore we should be thankful to Him. We thank our dear people from the bottom of our hearts as well. The people chanted the same slogans, the slogan of death to America. As I said the other day, this does not mean the American nation. On the 19th of Behman, I said who the slogan refers to. Now, I would like to say that death to America means death to imperialism and to transgression against the rights of nations. This is what it means.
Alhamdulillah, alhamdulillah, all praises to Allah, all praises to Allah.
The coronavirus pandemic battered the global economy like nothing else has done for decades. Prolonged nationwide lockdowns in some countries and mismanagement of the crisis in others have all contributed to 2020 becoming one of the gloomiest years for the global economy. It's not surprising to learn, according to a new report from the International Labor Organization, that workers around the world have lost $3.7 trillion since the pandemic began. Globally, 8.8% of working hours were lost, and 114 million people experienced employment loss, what the report called an unprecedented level. What's shocking is another report that made headlines. Billionaires around the world, who initially suffered massive losses like everyone else, have seen their wealth increase by $3.9 trillion as the entire globe has been grappling with the impacts of the deadly respiratory disease. That figure, according to the Oxfam report, is enough to vaccinate every single person on Earth against the coronavirus and help them stay out of poverty.
It's a new normal, but I don't think it's a sustainable new normal. So the level of increase in wealth is enormous. And it's already coming not out of the market system now, which is what caused the inequality before the financial crisis. It's now coming out of the impact of government policy. And this is really the ineffectiveness of government policy led by mainstream economists who have no idea of the role of inequality really in society. Most of their models talk about a representative agent where they lump together income from wages and income from profits as if we both receive them equally. So that level of naivety lies behind policies that believe we can revive the economies by boosting the wealth of the wealthy.
In the meantime, the workers may have to wait for a decade to be able to recover the losses they sustained. The report also estimates between 200 million to 500 million people may have fallen into poverty during 2020. Oxfam has said in its report that the world's billionaires' collective net worth is now standing at nearly $12 trillion, equivalent to what G20 countries have spent in response to the pandemic. The most vulnerable workers have faced some of the biggest job losses throughout the pandemic's recovery, and that K-shaped trajectory may continue.
They, and this is Ben Bernanke is on record as saying this, thought one way to revive the economy was to increase the value of shares and cause what he calls a wealth effect to encourage more spending and stimulate the economy. And I summarize that as trying to make the economy better by making the wealthy wealthier, because only a tiny fraction of the population owns shares, and that boosted their wealth without touching what happened with the remainder. Now, when COVID has struck, a very similar process is afoot. Central banks are buying bonds again, giving the financial sector large amounts of cash, which they then use to buy shares, which drives up share prices, and that's what's causing what's called the K-shaped recovery. Asset markets, particularly share markets, are skyrocketing, while at the same time, because workers can't go to work, due to lockdowns and the impact of COVID, the income of workers is falling.
The International Labour Organization said there were some encouraging signs of recovery at the start of 2021, with the COVID-19 vaccine gradually being deployed around the world. However, it's still estimated the continuing economic fallout would lead to a 3% loss of working hours globally in 2021, compared with the end of 2019, equivalent to 19 million full-time jobs. In a pessimistic scenario, which assumes slow progress on vaccination, working hours would fall by 4.6% this year, while in an optimistic path, the world economy would still lose 1.3% of working hours. The outcome would depend on how well the pandemic was brought under control and by how much consumer and business confidence recovered. A slow vaccine rollout and uneven distribution could also impact the speed at which the global economy recovers. This has led the World Bank and the International Monetary Fund to downgrade their respective outlooks. It seems that the only way out of the current economic situation for the governments around the world is aiming for a targeted recovery that prioritizes employment and would provide support for hard-hit workers and sectors.
Bangladesh's government sent another group of Rohingya Muslim refugees to a remote and deserted island in the Bay of Bengal. More than 1,400 refugees set sail for the island of Basanchar. It was the fourth group sent to the island, and the Bangladeshi government plans to eventually move 100,000 Rohingya to the remote island. Bangladesh also aims to decongest refugee camps in Cox's Bazar, which shelters approximately 1 million Rohingya. The relocations began in December and have been criticized by human rights groups who say that many of the refugees are being forced to move against their will. The government of Bangladesh says the relocation is voluntary, but many refugees have talked about the move as being coerced. Rights organizations say the Bangladeshi government used cash incentives as well as intimidation tactics to force Rohingya to accept the relocation offer. Bangladeshi authorities say the relocation is essential to ensure better living conditions for the refugees and to improve the camps in Cox's Bazar.
As a matter of fact, Bangladesh and India were among the countries which from the beginning opposed the incoming of these refugees. As a matter of fact, they identified them as terrorists and they did not give them what their rights under international law and under the humanitarian law as refugees. And we see that it's continuing. They see the Rohingya Muslims as a problem rather than sort of oppressed people that they need to be supported at this hour of need.
The refugee camp became overcrowded from August 2017, when Rohingya Muslims began fleeing their homes in Rakhine State following waves of attacks by Myanmar's army and Buddhist mobs. Hundreds of thousands of Muslims were violently uprooted in the months that followed, driven by a brutal military crackdown that killed thousands of them. What happened in August 2017 was so horrific that the UN called it genocide and a textbook example of ethnic cleansing. Those who survived the brutal killings sought refuge in Bangladesh and neighboring countries, hoping for a day to return home. But for now, it seems that thousands of them have to go on yet another perilous journey. The Rohingya are the world's most persecuted ethnic minority, haunted by the past and denied a future. A citizenship law in 1982 stripped them of their nationality, making them one of the world's largest stateless communities. While there have been waves of exodus to Bangladesh since the 1970s, none was as rapid and massive as the one in August 2017 that turned the spotlight on the Rohingya crisis around the world. Today, Bangladesh alone is home to nearly a million Rohingya refugees. At least half of those who arrived in the country were children. The UN says the migration was unprecedented in terms of volume and speed. These people know that they cannot stay in Cox's Bazar forever, but it seems that they are not wanted anywhere in this world.
Well, they're not really stateless in reality. They have a right to be citizens of Myanmar. They've been denied that basic fundamental right. is not the fact that, you know, by history they are stateless. Their citizenship has been denied, and you're absolutely right, that is the heart of the problem, and it will not be resolved unless the international community force the Myanmar government to rise up and accept their responsibility for looking after their own citizens.
There were talks of the Rohingya repatriation for the past couple of years, but to this day, nothing has happened. The main reason is that Myanmar's government was always unwilling to accept the refugees. Bangladesh has time and again pushed hard to begin the repatriation, but Myanmar has been delaying it, saying that it needs more time for logistical arrangements. The Rohingya Muslims also fear for their safety in case they return to their country. The UN fact-finding mission in Myanmar says that approximately 600,000 Rohingya are still inside the country, living under the threat of genocide. The world body says no refugees will agree to be repatriated without assurance of full citizenship, ethnic rights, to settle back in Myanmar. Given the Myanmar's leaders' reluctance to address the issue, the minority group's fate is a major cause for concern that is only being voiced by a select group of countries around the world.
The brawl between amateur investors and Wall Street professionals began with hedge funds and big corporations shorting the stock or betting on several small companies' fall of share prices. That captivated people's attention on social media, and in the wake of it, online campaigns led to the buying of the company's stock with the aim of pushing up the price. Companies like GameStop were shorted by hedge funds and were labelled as failing by big investors. However, the online movement dramatically soared prices with its stock, trading between $112 and $480 a share. That's up from around $18 a share a few weeks ago. That's while some investors were also hoping to make a quick buck, and others seeking to squeeze the hedge funds. The movement cost hedge funds and other big investors dearly, causing investment platforms such as Robinhood to put a ban on trading stock for GameStop, AMC, BlackBerry Limited, the Nokia Corporation, and several other companies, which resulted in shares to fall by 50%. This ignited protests outside the company's California headquarters and in the Manhattan banking district yesterday. Also, groups of angry protesters gathered in front of New York's stock exchange and chanted, "I want my money, and I want it now." They were also holding up signs which read, "Tax Wall Street and tax the rich." The act of restricting stock trade sparked lawsuits and called for investigations from lawmakers. Consequently, the Robinhood's co-founder, Vlad Tenev, announced that the suspension of trading of the stocks will be lifted, though only a limited amount of shares could be traded under the company's supervision. He also rejected the notion that this act is in favour of the hedge funds. The war between amateur investors and Wall Street has caused mayhem in the US stock market, with professional investors calling stock movements being obviously disconnected from fundamentals. However, how powerful are the big corporations, and can they restrict investors from buying shares and stopping individuals gaining a slice of the cake?
I think what we're seeing is people are extremely frustrated because a subgroup of people on Reddit have been able to game the system of Wall Street in their favor against billion-dollar hedge fund managers, and they're finally seeing a clamoring for regulation all of a sudden on Wall Street now that it's the people at the top that are being affected. For decades, for centuries, the Wall Street fat cats have been able to profit off the misery of others. They've made billions, trillions of dollars. They've gotten bailouts. They've done speculative measures. They've profited off of the misery of others, and yet nothing has happened.
Regulators in the United States have warned that the situation is under their scrutiny following a number of share trading platform suspension of trade stocks of the GameStop company and several other firms. One of these share trading platforms is Robinhood, a company that's been accused of gamifying share trades. Robinhood is also under fire for its decision to suspend trading and has sparked outrage among investors who accuse the firm of working in favor of hedge funds and big Wall Street investors who are losing millions of dollars to an army of novice traders.
The anger has now spread beyond the investment community, with US politicians joining the backlash against Wall Street. Democratic Representative Alexandra Ocasio-Cortez has called the restriction unacceptable, calling for more details to be published on Robinhood's decision. She also criticized suspending retail investors from purchasing stocks, while hedge funds are free to trade as they wished.
People are upset. People are upset that they have been able to outsmart those on Wall Street and turn a bigger profit for themselves. Some people were able to turn $30,000 into $1 million, etc. They want to continue to be able to do that, and they see this as an attack on the free market. Obviously, the market has never been free, and it continues to be a game that's completely rigged. But I think the defining point is the fact that finally the free market was able somehow to be used to help those who are more at the bottom than more at the top, and obviously you have the free market intervening to prevent this from happening further.
It seems that the online mania to steal from the rich and give to the poor has been betrayed by Robin Hood, who seems to be the real sheriff of Nottingham in this case. However, the fury against control of the system of big corporations and hedge funds has left people with no choice but to unite. But could the army of novice investors win a battle against the Goliath of big corporations and hunt down the real wolves of Wall Street?
The coronavirus pandemic has become an endless nightmare for much of the world. Despite the development and distribution of a range of new vaccines, many countries are still struggling to battle the deadly waves of the highly transmissible disease. As the world steps up efforts to contain the deadly virus, new variants are rapidly replacing older versions, making the situation even more frightening. Many thousands of people lose their lives every day worldwide, despite restrictive measures that have paralyzed economies. The pandemic could get much worse before it gets better. The world is undoubtedly eager to find out how the whole thing began so that future risks can be minimized. The origin of COVID-19 has been a major bone of contention, especially between the world's worst coronavirus-hit country, the United States, and China, where the deadly virus was first detected in December 2019. The two sides have exchanged barbs over the origin of the crisis. Now all eyes are focused on a fact-finding mission on the origins of the pandemic. A team of scientists from the World Health Organization is right now in the Chinese city of Wuhan, trying to find out the origins of the outbreak. The WHO says its fact-finding mission in Wuhan is purely scientific, but the probe is facing a political minefield. The World Health Organization team will carry out on-the-ground investigations into the source of the new coronavirus. The WHO scientists will visit different places in Wuhan and talk to people and officials. The WHO says all hypotheses are on the table during the probe. The WHO team is expected to inspect a seafood market in Wuhan, which was linked to many of the first COVID-19 cases in December 2019. The scientists will also visit hospitals that treat coronavirus patients in the city. But how much will the team of investigators be able to uncover? The WHO experts face a tough task as the city has been repeatedly disinfected. The investigation is ongoing in Wuhan, but there have been cautions against expecting any breakthroughs soon. It could take years before any firm conclusions can be reached. What's making the WHO mission even tougher is the fact that it has been highly politicized. Several countries, particularly the United States, accuse the Chinese government of hiding the outbreak's severity during its early stages. The administration of former U.S. President Donald Trump kept criticizing China for alleged failures in containing the outbreak and refusing to tell the truth. The WHO itself was branded by Trump as a, quote, puppet of China. The Chinese government has dismissed Western allegations, saying the virus might have begun outside of China. Trump is now gone, but the White House is keeping up pressure on Beijing.
White House Press Secretary Jen Psaki expressed concern this week about what she called misinformation coming out of China. Beijing has warned against any negative speculation and politicized interpretation of the fact-finding mission. Will the WHO scientists be able to carry out their investigation properly despite all the political pressure?
Obviously, the scientific medical investigation may help for future prevention or development of science in terms of understanding how viruses change and how the pandemic started and how the new virus originated. Obviously, among scientists, or at least the majority of scientists, believe what happened is a natural mutation of the virus.
Observers believe that the scientists should be allowed to complete their work independently because the results could prove vital for the future of mankind.
Iranian Radio, Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio.
Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. The program is Dialogue, and I'm your host, Mehdi. Today we want to talk about one of the great personalities in the early history of the Muslims, Imam Muhammad al-Baqir alayhi salam. Please stay tuned. Imam Muhammad al-Baqir was the direct descendant of the Holy Prophet Muhammad, and he was the fifth divinely appointed imam among the household of the Holy Prophet. He was the son of the fourth divinely appointed imam, Imam Ali ibn al-Husayn alayhi salam. Now all historians and traditionalists of Islam are unanimous that among the descendants of Imam Hassan and Imam Husayn, a maximum of religious sciences were expounded by Imam Muhammad al-Baqir. That is why the title of Al-Baqir was given to the Imam, which denotes one who splits knowledge. Imam Al-Baqir contributed greatly to the science of Quranic exegesis, scholastic theory, religious law, and Islamic jurisprudence, among many other subjects.
قال الإمام الباقر عليه السلام وجدت في الكتاب يعني كتابا لعلي عليه السلام أن قيمة كل امرئ وقدره معرفته إن الله تبارك وتعالى يحاسب الناس على قدر ما آتاهم من العقول في دار الدنيا.
Imam al-Baqir alayhi salam stated, "I found written in the book which is ascribed to Imam Ali alayhi salam that The worth and value of every man is his knowledge. Verily, Allah, blessed and most high, will take people to account according to his intellects that he has given them in this world's life.
Welcome back, dear listeners. It's an honor to have you with us. You're listening to Dialogue on IRIB English Radio. Dear friends, talking about the golden dialogues and very beautiful conversations which we find in the historical texts of Islam, we run across one very beautiful dialogue which is between Jabir bin Yazid and Imam al-Baqir alayhi salam. Now, Jabir bin Yazid is a very knowledgeable student. He is a wise companion of Imam al-Baqir alayhi salam. It is interesting, but when the student is a companion and the student is knowledgeable, then the teacher begins to teach things which he might not teach other students who are at a lesser point of knowledge and wisdom. And so in this conversation, we find that Imam al-Baqir actually puts forth very beautiful and very profound statements in this conversation. And this also shows us that Jabir al-Jufi was not just a regular companion of Imam al-Baqir. He must have been a very special companion of the Imam because of the beautiful and profound things that are exchanged in this conversation. One of the things that Imam al-Baqir alayhi salam says to Jabir al-Jufi in this truly golden conversation is that there is no obedience like performing the obligations. You know, dear friends, there are times where we think that we want to do something to obey Allah. We want to do something to be good servants, good creations of Allah. And, you know, sometimes we just don't know what to do. Well, here Imam al-Baqir, in this conversation with Jabir al-Jufi, tells us that the best kind of obedience of Allah, the Mighty, the Exalted, is that we perform our obligations. We perform our wajibat. And if we perform our wajibat, our obligations, our duties, our responsibilities as we should, then this is what is called obedience. Beautiful words exchanged in this golden conversation between Jabir al-Jufi and Imam al-Baqir alayhi salam.
Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. I am Atta, the host of the program Dialogue. Now, this moment, I invite you to listen to a short speech by Sheikh Ayyub Rashid. I hope you enjoy this part and stay tuned till the end of today's program.
When we look at the akhlaq of Imam alayhi salam, then you come to know that, according to narrations, Imam used to treat his family and friends very well. Whenever a family member would visit Imam, he would be fed well, clothed well, be given gifts, and so on and so forth. And similarly with the family. And Imam made it very clear, and he said, this dunya, the beauty of it is for you to share with your family members and your friends, and make sure you are closer to them. And his akhlaq made many people to be attracted by him and the madhab of Ahlul Bayt. For example, one narration says there was one particular individual who was not a Muslim, but he used to live with Muslims. He came and he called Imam, Anta Baqir, Anta Baqara, Baqar. Suratul Baqarah. Baqarah means cow. So he called Imam, "You are a cow. Wallah, for us, we would fight. We wouldn't allow that to happen to us. Or at least you use a foul language." But Imam alayhi salam said, No, I'm not Baqar. I am Baqir. I am Baqir. Then he continued. He said, "Anta ibn Tabakha. You are a son of that woman whose only work is just to cook." Imam alayhi salam said, "Oh, dhaka khirfatuha. That is her profession. So what's wrong with that? If she cooks, that's her profession." Then he continues, he said, "Ya ibn Sauda, oh, the son of that black woman, Azinjiya, a zinj, ex-slave, Albadiya, evil woman." This, for Imam, it was too heavy. Lakin Imam alayhi salam said, "In kunta sadaqta, ghafarallahu laha." In kunta sadaqta aw sadaqta, if you are saying the truth, ghafarallahu laha, may Allah forgive my mom. If she did whatever wrong, may Allah forgive her. Wa in kunta kadhabta, and if you are saying something which is not true, you are lying, ghafarallahu lak, may Allah forgive you. End of story. Allah. This particular individual was attracted by this. And after some time, he came to Imam, he apologized, and he said, "Wow, I'm sorry, I was wrong. I want to become a Muslim." And he accepted Islam. He became a Muslim because of the akhlaq of Ahlul Bayt alayhim as-salam.
Thank you very much, dear friends, for listening to this episode of Dialogue. Don't forget to log on to our website at parstoday.com. Until another episode, God bless you and fi amanillah.
ارزش‌ها و صفاتی که انسان احترام می‌گذاره، همه این ارزش‌ها در علی ابن ابی طالب جمعه.
Human in general, whether a Muslim, non-Muslim, or even a disbeliever, respect the values present in the character of Ali ibn Abi Talib.
لا يقيم أمر الله سبحانه إلا من لا يصانع ولا يضارع ولا يتبع المطامع.
Imam Ali alayhi salatu wasalam, the reason we love him as our hero, or not only in the material sense, in the spiritual sense, in the leadership sense.
Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. The program's to my brother, and I'm your host, Mahdi. We're talking about the universal persona of Imam Ali alayhi salam. Please stay with us. Imam Ali alayhi salam, the most distinguished and extraordinary personality in Islam after the Holy Prophet Muhammad. His entire life is a struggle for the advancement of Islam, the universal religion prescribed by Allah for all of humanity. Imam